Hello, welcome along to the show. My name's Dan, and there's no time for fuss, no time for waffle and chat. We've got lots to do. We've got a whole universe to explore. Come on. This is the Fun Kids Science Weekly podcast. And this week, we'll talk about a stinging nettle so dangerous, it makes people want to die. Also, we'll talk about the most powerful computer ever. And I'll answer some of the questions that you've left as a review over on the Apple Podcast Store. Today, they're on eyes and on vultures being sick. That's on the way first. Let's catch up with one of our favourite geniuses here on the Science Weekly, letting us know how everything around us is actually made. It's a Sydney McSprocket.
How's it made?
Oh, hello. Sir Sydney McSprocket here. I've been in action capturing facts all about manufacturing. It's for this rather splendid stipendiary compendium I'm compiling. You just ask it how something is made, and it'll oblige with a fulsome explanation. I'm getting stuck in to some sticky tape. So stick around, you might learn something. You see what I did there?
Step one.
Tiny pellets of a substance called cellulose acetate are melted in large vats. These will make the clear plastic part of the tape.
Step two.
The melted plastic is spread over wide conveyor belts and dried to form a very thin, clear plastic sheet, which is wound onto giant rolls.
Step three.
An adhesive, oh, that's the gluey sticky bit, is prepared. Oh, different types of tape use different adhesives. Some are strong, some are the sort you can reposition.
Step four.
The clear plastic sheets are rolled over the adhesive, picking up the sticky stuff as they go. Sometimes they'll be treated with another chemical first to help the glue attach evenly. After being coated, computers check that the layer of glue is even. The glue dries quickly, but sometimes ovens are used to speed up the process. The sheets are then wound onto new rolls.
Step five.
It's then just a matter of cutting the large rolls into smaller ones, ready for the packaging.
Step six.
Quality control is a very important part of any manufacturing process. Out of each batch of tape made, a roll will be tested. One of these tests might include rolling a ball bearing down a slope onto the sticky side of the tape. If the tape has been correctly manufactured, the ball will get stuck. If not, the tape's not up to the job and will be binned. Well, that neatly packages up that topic. Now, I must get on, but come back soon and find out more about manufacturing with my splendid stipendiary compendium.
How's it made? With support from the Royal Commission for the 1851 exhibition. Find out more at funkidslive.com.
Right, it's question time on the show. One of my favourite parts of the Science Weekly, you know, when you help me turn into a little sciencey Sherlock. You give me a little problem and a puzzle to solve. I have to squirrel away online and through encyclopedias sorting it out for you. If you've got a question that you want me to answer for you, you need to leave it as a review over on Apple Podcasts. That's what Mia May has done, who asks, how does our eyes see? It's quite a big one, Mia May. There's quite a lot going on in there. I'll try and breeze through it as quick as I can. What happens is light enter the eyes through the cornea, which is a clear window right in front of your eye. And then what happens is the light gets refracted by the cornea. It gets split into colours and it's sort of bent in a way that all the light in front of you can fit through a tiny pupil. You've also got the iris there that works a little bit like a shutter in a camera. It makes the image in front of you bigger or smaller and therefore easier for your brain to understand. Now, the light that's then been refracted hits the retina that's at the back of the eye, which is split into many parts, by the way, the retina. You've got the macula, which is kind of a bullseye in the middle of the retina, and it's got photoreceptors in it, which are all nerve endings. And these convert the light that hits the retina into electric signals that get sent to your brain, which then understands them, figures out what all the colours are and what's actually going on inside you. So there you go, Mia. I think we could do quite a detailed one of that. That's just a little whistle-stop tour of the eye for you. Right, the next one is from Luke in London. It's quite a random one, Luke. Get this. Luke asks, why don't vultures get food poisoning? I mean, why is anyone ever thinking of that? I love the way that your mind's going, Luke, though. I think if you're thinking things that no one else is thinking, you're probably on the right track. I found it out for you, though. There's quite a lot to do with this, Luke. The first is because they don't eat too much rotten meat, although we think they do. It's a surprise, isn't it? Vultures are known for chomping on carrion. Or is that for being carrion? No, I think they are carrion. Yeah, they're picking apart all the dead animals that have been out on the road or in the desert for a while. But when they sense that the animals that are dead are really starting to rot, they'll avoid it. They'll fly somewhere else. Also, vultures have got an amazing resistance to most diseases in them. They don't really get infected by botulism or anthrax or cholera or salmonella. And that would be rife through humans if we were to eat dead animals that we found in the desert. Also, vultures have got extremely acidic stomachs, which destroys most of the bacteria and the parasites that they do eat before they reach the intestines and really take control. And actually, vultures are quite useful because they stop the spread of diseases because they eat the infected carcass and they digest the deadly microbes before they can reproduce and spread to other humans. So there you go, Luke. I mean, I said it was quite a random question at the start, but it's actually incredibly interesting. Let us learn loads more about nature and who we are, really. Thank you so much for that. If you've got a question that you want answered on the show, you need to leave it as a review over on Apple Podcasts. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, the Science Museum and Equinor, they're opening their Young Imagineers competition for another year. They're challenging you to come up with something innovative that could make the world a better place. So we're talking about ways of using, like, the wild inventions that you can imagine, bring them to life using science. Now, Barry Fitzgerald is a judge of the prize. He is the author of The Secrets of Superhero Science. And he's on the line right now to talk about how we can make superpowers happen in real life. Barry, hello.
Dan, how are you doing?
I am very well, thank you. So now I'm looking at the Science Museum in Equinor, along with the competition. They've done a lot of research about what superpowers kids would like to see. Now, a third of kids say that they would like to have invisibility to make the world a better place. So, invisibility, can it ever be made real?
Invisibility, I think, is one of those powers or abilities that many people are fascinated by. The short answer is yes. To make somebody or something invisible surely is possible. And there are many scientists and researchers who are pursuing this, and they're taking two ways of doing it. So the first way is you make really expensive materials. They're called metamaterials. And what they do is they bend light around objects in ways we don't normally see every day. But the problem with these materials is that they're very, very expensive to make. The cheaper option is that you just use optical lenses and you set them up in a very, very unique and specific way. So that they're like the lenses you'd find in a pair of glasses or even in a car headlamp, for example. And I actually have one of these invisibility cloaks on my table in front of me right now.
Right.
So that is an invisibility cloak made of optical lenses.
So what happens when you look at an invisibility cloak that's been made of these optical lenses?
So how it works is it's quite simple. It's four optical lenses. So just like, as I say, like the lenses you'd have in a pair of glasses. And you just place them in a certain configuration or a certain way. So they're all on what's called an optical bench to make sure they're all steady. And then you place them at specific locations. And what happens is that when you look in from one end towards the other end, the light will get bent in a certain way so that there will actually be regions which are cloaked. So that, in fact, if you put an object in there, you won't see that object.
Now, is it as simple as just not seeing it? Or perhaps, is it strange when I look at it? Will my eyes be distorted? For instance, I don't know, Barry, if you've ever had like a migraine. And how the migraines start, I always find, is you get like those light spinning round things that occasionally you get when you've looked at light too much. Is it that type of optical illusion? Is it going to be a bit discomforting, or will I not notice it and it will just be as much as anything's not there?
It will be as if it's just as a normal, it's like looking through a pair of binoculars. That's the way to be, or a telescope or a microscope. I suffer from migraines too, and they're very, very something definitely you don't want to be suffering from. But certainly when you look through this, you don't have to worry about getting a migraine from looking through it. And I have it set up here on my desk, and I have an object which I'm trying to cloak or make invisible is actually just a piece of Lego or a Lego bridge. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to look through the other end to see Ant-Man, who's actually at the other end. One of these Ant-Man figures is just standing there. And my hope is that when I look through from one end towards the other, I'll see Ant-Man's face, and I'll find that it's not blocked by the Lego bridge, which means that the invisibility cloak has cloaked or made invisible this Lego bridge.
Right, so the next super strength that kids want through this study, 35% have said that they would like superhuman strength and speed. Now, do scientists have any clue, like, humans' maximum capacity for strength and speed? Because, you know, we're always getting faster, we're always getting stronger. Do we have any idea where it might stop?
Let's look back last month. The marathon world record was broken. It's down now to 2 hours and 1 minute 39 seconds, which is extraordinary. And the big aim in the marathon, for example, is trying to get a sub-2-hour marathon. I think we're getting very close towards physical limitations of the human body by itself. And in terms of speed, in terms of strength. And at a certain point, then we have to look at what I call add-ons to help us do that. Now, luckily, scientists are actually doing that at the moment. And they're looking at making things like exoskeleton suits. So these are like suits that you can wear on the outside of your body. And they allow you to do things more easily or allow you to do things you could not do before. So to give you an example, many military organizations are looking to make exoskeleton suits that make it easier for soldiers to walk, carrying very large loads. So many soldiers might have to carry 60 or 70 kilograms of equipment, which can be very tiring for them. And of course, at the end of the day, it's something that could really wear their body out. But if they have an exoskeleton suit, it would allow them to lift more for longer and to walk further with that load. So in order to push the boundaries in terms of strength, I think the way to do that would be to wear an exoskeleton suit, just like, for example, Iron Man. He wears an exoskeleton suit and he's able to lift objects and carry things that he would not be able to do if he didn't have the suit.
Now, this might be a really stupid question, but going back to your marathon runners, how are we constantly getting faster? Like, what are these runners doing that's making them quicker?
So I actually run. I am definitely not a 2-hour marathon man. I am miles away from that. But from my own perspective, how I've got faster is you train, you eat right, you eat healthily, you follow an exercise program, and you strive then to see if that will actually give you the end result of going faster.
But that's to a point, surely, Barry, though. I mean, when you're getting to 205, 204, we're talking about the muscles. How can someone's muscle be so different to everyone else's that they can race through at that pace?
I think what the differences you're seeing there, it comes down to genetics fundamentally. So everybody's different, the DNA is different, and because the DNA is different, everyone's able to do different things. So the example I would give is that with a lot of these runners is that their DNA might be different from my DNA. Now, we both can run. It's just that when they run, they're able to run faster and further because, for example, maybe their muscles have been designed in a way that they're able to keep going for longer. They don't get tired as quickly. And I think one of the biggest examples is there's an ultramarathon runner called Dean Karnazes. This man can run incredible distances. I'll give you an example. He's run 560 kilometers in about 72 or 78 hours nonstop without sleeping. He only stops to eat. He doesn't sleep. Now, he says that he doesn't get muscle cramp in the same way that I would get muscle cramp, or many people would get muscle cramp after the exercise. And this has to come down fundamentally to his genetics, how his body is designed, what's in his DNA, because his DNA has something that I just don't have.
And lastly, 33% of kids, in order to make the world a better place, they'd like to travel through time. This has been something that scientists and people have dreamed about, for centuries. Is it possible at all?
Time travel is possible. Absolutely possible. You can go forward in time. It's complicated. What you need to do is you need to take a rocket to go into outer space. You need to find yourself a nice black hole. You need to go into orbit around that black hole. Not too close, because you don't want to get sucked in, but you just want to be some distance away from the black hole and stay in orbit around that black hole for some time. And then when you pop out from the orbit, you'll find that you've actually traveled to the future. And this is all because of how Albert Einstein's famous theory of general relativity describes how basically time can slow down in space when you're close to very large gravitational objects. Now, perhaps I'm not seeing something, and maybe one of the people that enters this Young Imagineers competition will maybe come up with another way to time travel. And it's something that I certainly would love to see. I would love to see, for example, a real DeLorean car like they had in Back to the Future that can actually time travel. That may be a long way off, but maybe, as I say, maybe I'm missing something, and hopefully one of the entries in the Young Imagineers competition will see something that I don't.
Brilliant. Well, Barry, yeah, so the Science Museum in Equinor's Young Imagineer competition, it's still open right now. So if you're quick about it, if you find out online, you can come up with a really great idea that could change the way that the world works in the future. Barry, yeah, thank you so much for coming on. Brilliant. It's been great to talk to you.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Dan.
This week's Dangerous Dan is a stinging nettle that's so painful, it might even drive you mad. Dendrocnide moraides. It's also called Gympie Gympie because it's mainly found in the Gympie region of Australia. It grows in the rainforests in the north of the country, and apparently it's got one of the most painful stingers in the world. People compare it to a mixture of being burned by acid and being electrocuted at the same time. It looks like a bigger version of the regular stinging nettle. Only just a brush of this one against your skin will leave dozens of barbs from the leaf embedded inside you. And they'll keep releasing this brutal venom over time. Now, it doesn't paralyse you like many other venomous toxic things, but it does leave this pain for ages. It goes on for days and weeks, possibly even months. Some of the stories of those who have been stung by the Gympie Gympie are terrifying. Like this one from an old army man, Cyril Bromley. He fell into the plants during training, and he ended up being strapped to a hospital bed because he was scratching so much they were worried about what he might do to himself. Now, they say everything in Australia is out to kill you, and it turns out that stinging nettles are no different. It's time for another expert on the Science Weekly right now. This is our weather genius, our climate guru, Marina Ventura.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers.
Hi there, Marina Ventura here. I love finding out about the natural world, and that includes the Earth's climate. We know that weather can change from one day to the next, but climates can change too, over the time span of years, centuries, or even longer. So I'm on a mission to fill MapUp with the latest climate information with the help of some awesome climate explorers. Come on then, let's go. There's a lot more to the ground under our feet than the pavement.
That's right. There's lots of stuff under the streets, from pipes carrying water and waste to cables delivering energy and the internet to our schools and homes. There might also be an underground railway under your feet. But as well as man-made objects, you might also find things that can tell us what the planet used to be like. Here's a clue. Fossils, such as woolly mammoth or saber-toothed cat remains, are incredibly valuable. They don't just tell us what creatures on Earth were like thousands of years ago. They can also give us clues about the environment too.
And even the soil itself is packed full of clues about past climate changes. Let's talk to a climate explorer who's getting to the bottom of some climate conundrums.
Hi, I'm Matt. By looking at old rocks and soils, we can learn about what the world used to be like. I'm especially interested in Ice Age climate and how glaciers shape and change the landscape during a cold period of the natural climate cycle. Did you know England was once buried under miles of ice? We can learn about this by looking at the landscape that all this ice carved out and the soils they left behind, like muds that formed in the bottom of lakes that were created when glaciers melted at the end of the last ice age. As well as digging holes to find rock and soil samples, I use special equipment that can see through the ground and create images of what's buried deep beneath my feet.
Sounds like a lot of fun. But how do you see through the ground? Sounds like you'd need some X-ray specs or lasers for that.
Well, not quite. We use something called a ground-penetrating radar. It sends pulses into the earth. The way those pulses behave can tell us what's down there.
That would be a really great app for you, Maffy.
The weather conditions over time can cause rocks and soil to behave in different ways. By studying really old samples, we can understand some of the natural ways that climate has changed over millions of years. This helps in two ways. It helps us to learn what to expect when the earth changes naturally and how fast this happens, and also helps us see which changes are natural and which are new, caused by modern-day effects such as pollution and deforestation. I've travelled to lots of exciting places. I've scanned sand dunes in Morocco, explored volcanoes in Spain, although they weren't erupting at the time, and also have dug up sea sediment in the English Channel.
Really valuable work. Thanks, Matt. Learning from our Earth's history makes a lot of sense. After all, the planet has been around for 4.5 billion years, and humans have only been a tiny fraction of that.
And climate explorers like Matt can help share that knowledge.
Talking of sharing knowledge, ready for upload, Mappy?
Load me up.
Next time, we'll be taking a walk in the woods, finding out more about how studying the forests can help us learn more about the Earth's climate. See you soon.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers, supported by the Natural Environment Research Council, the science of the natural world. Find out more at funkidslive.com/marina.
It's time to talk about all the science that has been in your news this week. And it's a big story to start because Google say an advanced computer has achieved quantum supremacy for the first time, surpassing other devices. The Sycamore quantum processor was able to perform a task in 200 seconds that would take the world's best supercomputers 10,000 years to complete. You see, in classical computers, a unit of information is called a bit, and it has a value of either 1 or 0. But in a quantum system, you get the qubit, the quantum bit. It can be both a 1 and a 0. They can both be the same, which means more than one calculations can be done at once. Also, Jeff Bezos from Amazon has announced the formation of a national team that will aim to build a lander that will take astronauts back to the moon in 2024, which carries on a corporate space travel, which is quite a thing at the moment, with Virgin, with Elon Musk's SpaceX, and now Amazon all getting involved. It's part of his Blue Origin space company, and he said it's a national priority for America to get back to the moon. And finally, a little bit closer to home, studies of the seas off the coast of Northern Ireland have shown a mixed picture. There were positive findings in contaminants, it looks like they're going down, but most seabird populations, like kittiwakes and puffins and herring gulls, they all remain at risk. And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. If you've got a question that you really want answered by me on the show, if you want to turn me into a little sciencey Sherlock, you need to leave it as a review over on Apple Podcasts. Find the Fun Kids Science Weekly on there. Leave your name so I know who to say hello to. There's a little comment box at the bottom. That's where you leave your question. And 5 stars really helps me see it as well. While you're on Apple Podcasts, it's a brilliant way for you to hear all the science series that we do. You've heard some today. There are loads more out there. You can also get them on the free Fun Kids app, on Google, on Spotify, and at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids, we're a children's radio station from the UK. You can hear us all around the country on your DAB digital radio, on that free Fun Kids app, and at funkidslive.com.